well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be taking a look at what happened in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals on Wednesday, where a case dealing with right to carry reciprocity was heard. The plaintiff in this case lost at the district court level. There were actually two plaintiffs originally, but one of them has actually dropped out. So the remaining plaintiff, Jeffrey Johnson Sr., he's a over-the-road truck driver. He has carry permits from Georgia and Florida, but he wants to be able to lawfully carry in Minnesota. Minnesota does not recognize either of those permits. So Johnson has sued the state, arguing that Minnesota's failure to honor those permits places an unreasonable burden on his right to bear arms, that essentially the Second Amendment is being treated as a second-class right by Minnesota's failure to recognize permits from all states. Right now, Minnesota has reciprocity with about 33 states. It used to be fewer because Minnesota required concealed carry applicants to be 21 until Worth versus Jacobs, and that was a lawsuit filed by a Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus, and the Eighth Circuit overturned that requirement. So now 18, 19, and 20-year-olds in Minnesota can lawfully acquire a concealed carry license, and that opens up reciprocity with other states where 18, 19, and 20-year-olds can carry. But, again, not every state is recognized. And so Johnson's argument, again, is that without essentially universal reciprocity, the right to keep and bear arms is being infringed. Now, I will say, I don't think it went too well for Mr. Johnson and his attorneys yesterday. Courthouse News Service, Eighth Circuit presses challenge to Minnesota gun permit law. The appellate panel pushed back on the idea that the Second Amendment requires Minnesota to honor firearms permits from every state. So let's get into some of the coverage here. Courthouse News says the three-judge appellate panel did not seem to buy the unreasonable burden argument, largely questioning whether anything was concretely wrong with Minnesota's permit laws. U.S. Circuit Judge Stephen Graz, a Donald Trump appointee, asked, well, if Minnesota can require all of its residents to get a permit, why would it violate the Second Amendment by requiring others to do the same? U.S. Circuit Judge Ralph Erickson agreed, piling on to the questioning against Johnson's attorney, Ryan Morrison, asking, is it your position that having conceded that the Minnesota permitting process is appropriate for Minnesota residents, that Minnesota must enact a statute that allows reciprocity or else they're in violation of the Second Amendment? Do you have a case that says that anywhere in the world? He went on to voice his concern about Morrison's argument, quote, finding it absurd that those outside of Minnesota should not be held to the same standard as residents. He asked, so you have greater rights as a non-resident than as a resident? It just says if you want to go into Minnesota, you've just got to follow Minnesota's permitting process. Now, there are a couple of issues with Judge Erickson's point of view here. First, as we've recently seen, I'm blanking on the name of the couple, Tom Knighton covered this at Bearing Arms. They decided to see, okay, if I want to carry in all 50 states, how much is it going to cost me to do this? What they found out is about $5,000, not just in permitting fees, but in some cases having to travel to these states in order to apply for a carry permit. If you want to carry in Massachusetts, for example, you can't apply online as a non-resident. You have to go to Massachusetts and meet with a licensing authority and then submit your application, and hopefully you'll be approved. And by the way, I think you got to do that every 2 years. Massachusetts is not the only state that requires this. California originally didn't have reciprocity with any other state and had no process for non-residents to apply. And then I believe they wanted to have a system where non-residents could apply, but they had to apply in person. That, I think, has been struck down. But there are other states where, yes, you definitely have to go there in person to drop off your application. Now, you don't have to do that to drive in any other state, right? And driver's license, frankly, driving is a privilege. Traveling, however, is not. And this is where the argument gets really interesting. And unfortunately, where Johnson's attorney, I think, could have and should have raised a legal argument that he did not. And under the rules of the court, if you don't raise an argument at the district court level, you can't bring it up during an appeal. So one of the issues that Johnson's attorney left on the table were the traveler's laws. Costas Morris, who was our guest yesterday in the program, wrote a fantastic brief for the Second Amendment Foundation. It's an amicus brief in a case called Gardner versus Maryland. Supreme Court is set to hear this case in conference about a month from now, April 17th. I don't know if they're going to grant cert, but this is another right to carry reciprocity issue. The plaintiff in this case, actually, I guess the defendant in this case, was a woman who at the time lived in Virginia. I think she now lives in North Carolina. She crossed over into Maryland. She could legally carry in Virginia. Maryland doesn't recognize Virginia permits, so she was charged with illegally carrying a firearm. And the amicus brief that Costas Morris wrote, and I want to make sure that I get the name of the other attorneys who were involved in the writing of this brief as well. Chuck Michelle and Anna Brevere from Michelle and Associates also were involved in this brief. They talk about the traveler's exceptions in historic laws going back to the colonial period, but continuing on really throughout U.S. history, at least most of U.S. history. They write, before 1900, carrying a firearm openly generally did not involve a permit or any other permission from the government. Concealed carry, on the other hand, was often restricted or banned entirely, and courts generally approved of this arrangement. But they say there was one frequent exception. Travelers from other states were often allowed to carry their firearms concealed. The historic tradition of these traveler's exception laws is not some outlier, they wrote, but overwhelming to the point that it justifies the Supreme Court summarily reversing the Fourth Circuit's decision in Gardner versus Maryland. It's especially relevant here, they write, given that the petitioner was arrested while driving through the state. This is exactly what the petitioner in, I believe it's Johnson versus Ellison, or maybe Johnson versus Minnesota, wants to do. Again, he's an over-the-road truck driver. Wants to be able to have his firearm on his person while he's traveling throughout the state rather than having to pull over right before he gets to the state line, unload his firearm, put it in a locked case so that he can transport it illegally across the state of Minnesota. As this brief notes, the tradition began in the colonial era. In 1686, the province of East Jersey prohibited privately wearing various weapons but exempted, quote, all strangers traveling upon their lawful occasions through the province, behaving themselves peaceably. In 1813, Kentucky law, they write, was perhaps the earliest post-founding example, prohibiting the concealed carry of certain weapons, quote, unless when traveling on a journey. In 1820, Indiana law was similar. The state essentially banned concealed carry, but said, quote, it shall not be so construed as to affect travelers. The brief says, by the end of the antebellum era, at least three other states, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Alabama, had also banned concealed carry, but had provided express exceptions for travelers. And they say the tradition continued well after the Civil War. 1867 Nevada law barred concealed carry for everyone who was not a, quote, peace officer or traveler. And 1864 California law did the same. And they write that travelers' exceptions also applied to the rare jurisdictions that implemented more comprehensive carry bans that were not limited only to concealed carry. In 1871, for example, Texas instituted a fine for anybody who was caught carrying on or about his person, saddle, or in his saddlebags any pistol, dirk, dagger, slungshot, sword cane, spear, brass knuckles, bowie knife, or any other kind of knife manufactured or sold for the purposes of offense or defense, providing, however, that the preceding article shall not apply to persons who are traveling. They note that the Arizona Territory had a similar ban in the 1880s, but also provided that any person traveling from one village, town, or settlement to another shall be permitted to carry firearms of any kind. In 1887, the New Mexico Territory banned all carry of deadly weapons except that, quote, persons traveling may carry arms for their own protection while actually prosecuting their journey and may pass through settlements on the road without disarming. Now, the Supreme Court has said that, you know, territorial laws, they don't really matter that much. These were typically short-lived laws. But this does, you know, taken with the others that we just mentioned, note, and I think designate, a national tradition within gun ownership of doing exactly what this judge in Minnesota expressed incredulity about. You have greater rights as a non-resident than as a resident? Historically so, yes. If you were traveling, yes. There were regulations that were in burdens that were placed on citizens of the state that were not placed on travelers going through the state. Now, again, this is an argument that was not made yesterday. It could not be made yesterday. Costas Morris, a couple of months ago when he found out about this case, he said he was kicking himself because he learned about this case too late to file an amicus brief. He suggested maybe the attorney for Mr. Johnson could try to bring this up anyway. It doesn't sound like Morrison did that. So I think maybe the best argument in the plaintiff's favor in this case was left on the table, and the three-judge panel did not hear anything about the traveler's exception in many states. Instead, Morrison, Johnson's attorney, countered by saying that Minnesota can absolutely require residents to obtain a permit, but that lawful permit-holding individuals from other states should not have to get another permit just to carry in Minnesota. He says an individual can only be disarmed if that person has been proven to be a danger to the public. The people without a state unrecognized firearms licenses have already proven to be law-abiding citizens. That's a decent argument for what it is. The Supreme Court did suggest, in Rahimi, that individuals can be temporarily disarmed only after there has been a judicial finding of that the person poses a danger to themselves or others. A permanent prohibition on possessing firearms would obviously require that same finding of dangerousness, right? Now, the state's argument, though, is that we're not saying you can't have a gun. Johnson can absolutely have a gun as he's going through Minnesota. He just can't carry it. He can have it in his truck. He just has to keep it locked up where it's not accessible to him. Ammunition has got to be unloaded, right? But we're not depriving him of his right to keep an arm. We're just saying if he wants to bear arms, that he has to do so in accordance with Minnesota law. And that means you got to have the training requirements that Minnesota requires, or at least similar requirements, which is why we don't recognize these other permits that Johnson possesses. Morrison said, under Minnesota's carry reciprocity law, everyone without a recognized permit must remove their weapon and place it in a container once they enter the state. There's no judicial finding that these people are a danger to the public. Johnson's Second Amendment rights are being treated like a second-class right. The judges were interested in this, according to Courthouse News. They asked the state's attorney if Minnesota was placing an unreasonable burden on out-of-state individuals who seek to obtain a permit of the state, but the assistant AG said it's not Minnesota's job to make it easier. He said the Second Amendment does not require Minnesota to make it easier for out-of-state residents to get a firearm license than Minnesotans. And again, if Morrison could have raised the traveler's exception argument, then he could have said, actually, Minnesota does have a duty to recognize that travelers have a lesser burden than residents of a state, that there is a national tradition of this. So, I'll be honest. I mean, just based on Courthouse News reading of the oral arguments, I'm not particularly confident that we're going to get a favorable ruling from this three-judge panel. I guess Johnson could ask to take this en banc, or he could appeal this directly to the Supreme Court. Now, again, you've got Gardner versus Maryland. That's going to be heard in conference next month, so that's well ahead of Johnson's case. We don't know what the court is going to do with Gardner versus Maryland, but the traveler's exception argument has been raised in that case, at least in amicus briefs. I'm not Johnson's attorney, but I think I would Hey, I'd be reaching out to other Second Amendment groups, first of all, and asking them for help with amicus briefs in this case. The Eighth Circuit, you know, did give gun owners a favorable ruling in Worth versus Jacobson. So maybe it's worth taking this case en banc, or at least asking to take this case en banc. You're not guaranteed that that's going to happen if they do lose at the appellate level. But either way, interested parties should at least be raising this issue wherever this case ends up next, whether it's at an en banc panel in the Eighth Circuit, whether it's before the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, one of the challenges that we see in this particular case, again, is that Minnesota can argue that this isn't an utter deprivation of the right to keep and bear arms, right? You can keep a gun if you want as you're traveling through Minnesota, but if you want to bear arms, again, you have to do so in compliance with Minnesota statute. Now, again, from a common sense standpoint, that's really difficult when you apply that standard across all 50 states. Because now you are talking about thousands of dollars, not just in application fees, but in the cost of airline tickets or gas to visit these places to apply for a license. And again, if you're somebody like Mr. Johnson, an over-the-road truck driver, you're supposed to park your rig and then fly to Massachusetts. You can apply so you can carry in Massachusetts and then go back to your job. I mean, you are asking, that is an unreasonable burden. If you want to carry in all 50 states, it is unreasonable. I absolutely agree it is unreasonable to expect a gun owner to visit all of the states that do not have reciprocity with the state where they live, or to acquire a number of permits that would allow you to carry in, 40 some odd states, and then jump through all of the hoops and hurdles necessary to get the remaining permits. And I'm not sure if I think this is being litigated right now, but I'm still not sure that Hawaii offers non-residents the opportunity to get a carry permit. I don't think they do. But again, that should be challenged if it is not already being challenged. That is an unreasonable burden. It is too much to ask of gun owners to jump through all of those hoops and hurdles to spend that amount of money and that amount of time simply to be able to exercise their Second Amendment rights in all 50 states. Again, is that a legal argument? No, it's a common sense argument. But the legal argument, I think, maybe the best one, again, is that traveler's exception, because there is that national tradition of recognizing that travelers, not that they have more Second Amendment rights than residents of a particular state, but that the burden for them to be able to bear arms in self-defense, it's not unreasonable to say that it should be less than that of a resident, as long as they're traveling through that state. So we'll keep our eyes on what's going on with the Eighth Circuit decision here. It's probably not going to come out until, I'd say at least 3 or 4 months from now, maybe and quite possibly longer than that. Fingers crossed we get a good decision, but I'm not hopeful that that's going to be the case. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day, but also keep your fingers crossed for Gardner versus Maryland, because that is an opportunity for the court to weigh in on right to care reciprocity well before this Eighth Circuit case gets to SCOTUS. All right, so now on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We're going to start there with I don't know if I've ever actually used the New York Times as a source for one of our recidivist reports, and this is not, again, a true recidivist report, but it is a what the heck are they thinking report, I guess. Headline from the New York Times: she killed a family with her speeding car. Is probation enough? 2 years ago, an older driver killed a couple, their toddler, and their baby as her vehicle sped through San Francisco. A judge has indicated that he intends to let her avoid prison, home detention, and community service. That's a pretty clickable headline, isn't it? So the woman in question is now 80 years old. This was 2 years ago, so I guess she was 78 at the time. New York Times reports that Mary Fong Lau is expected to plead no contest on Friday to four felony counts of vehicular manslaughter. In exchange, she is likely to avoid prison or home detention. Again, it was 2 years ago that Mary Fong Lau, behind the wheel of a white Mercedes SUV, traveling at a very high rate of speed, jumped the sidewalk in the West Portal neighborhood of San Francisco, sheared a street pole, smashed a bolted down garbage can, obliterated a bus stop, according to the New York Times, and finally came to a halt when it crashed into a fire hydrant. At that bus stop, there was a family of four. Diego Cardoza de Oliveira was hit, went airborne, landed more than 100 feet away, according to witnesses. Matilde Ramos Pinto was trapped in the wreckage of that bus stop. Rolf O'Grady, who was one of the witnesses there and ran to the scene, he said he thought a bomb had gone off because of the loud boom. He said, "I was talking to the lady, making sure she stayed awake. She didn't say a word. I just kept telling her that her baby was fine." But the three-month-old was not fine. The couple's son, Joaquim, 20 months old, his body landed next to his father's, was left unrecognizable, according to the New York Times. Within days, the paper writes, all four would be dead. The three-month-old baby, Kawi, was the last to die after his two grandmothers made the decision to pull him from life support. And Mary Fong Lau, again, now 80 years old, is expected to plead guilty to four counts of vehicular manslaughter tomorrow. And a judge has indicated that he will keep her out of prison, not even home detention, 2 to 3 years of probation, Judge Bruce Chan said in a hearing last month. He said prison time would amount to mere vengeance. And he said home detention and community service would not serve any purpose. He cited her age, her lack of a criminal record, her expressions of remorse. He said, "My feeling is that just as this family is forever imprisoned in the grief and the tragedy, Ms. Lau is also going to spend the rest of her days living with the knowledge of the harm that she caused so many others." That may very well be. I would assume that Ms. Lau did not intentionally strike this family. That something happened that day. Maybe she got the gas pedal confused with the brake pedal. I don't know. But I would assume that yes, she did not mean to kill this family of four. According to the New York Times, there is agreement among the family's relatives, the district attorney, and witnesses at the crash site that keeping an 80-year-old woman out of prison makes sense. They say there is precedent for the light manslaughter sentencing of an older driver. In 2003, 86-year-old George Weller killed 10 pedestrians at the Santa Monica Farmers Market after confusing the gas and brake pedals. He got 5 years of probation. Judge in that case said that Mr. Weller's age and declining health had contributed to his decision. Still, the New York Times writes, in San Francisco, some relatives described the proposed sentence as too light. The district attorney has filed a motion asking Judge Chan to reconsider. She doesn't think that Lau should go to prison, but she also believes that she deserves punishment beyond probation. Under the terms suggested by the judge, by the way, Ms. Lau would be eligible to get her driver's license back after she serves those 3 years of probation, which is absolutely absurd. This, to me, I think, is the crux of the issue here. Even if you don't believe that Ms. Lau intentionally meant to kill this family of four, should she ever be able to get behind the wheel of a car again? And I would say the answer is no. At 80 years old, you have proven yourself, again, if this is an innocent mistake or not, It came with deadly consequences. And frankly, I don't think she should be trusted to get behind the wheel of a vehicle. So how do you do that if she's not in prison? Well, for one, yes, you do ensure that she can't get her driver's license back, but it doesn't mean she can't get behind the wheel of a car. Sure, she'd be breaking the law, but criminals do that every day, right? Home detention, mandated community service, that's what the district attorney wants, and the permanent revocation of her driver's license. The victim's family, by the way, is kind of skeptical of Lau's remorse. They say that shortly after the crash, she transferred several properties that she owned in California out of her trust and into the names of family members, perhaps to avoid having to sell those properties in the civil suit that had been filed later. Her current attorney, though, says she was given bad advice by a previous lawyer. Honestly, I wouldn't shed a tear if Ms. Lau was sentenced to prison. I wouldn't. But if that's not the right place for her because of her age, I don't like that argument. But if that's the thinking there, then yes, home detention, permanent revocation of her driver's license. I don't even know about community service because, again, I don't want her out in public. I would be fine if, in lieu of prison, she is sent to a retirement home where she can be driven around, but not have access to any type of motor vehicle at all. And in San Francisco, even that might be too tough a punishment for an 80-year-old who killed a family of four. So we'll keep our eyes on this story. We'll give you an update. Probably on Monday, we'll be able to let you know what happened at that hearing on Friday. But it's a very disturbing story. Now, today's Armed Citizen story from Chicago, Illinois. Also kind of disturbing because, again, a 16-year-old in this case, able to violate all of Illinois' restrictive gun laws, illegally acquire a handgun, and allegedly use that handgun in an attempted armed robbery. As it happens, the 16-year-old picked a bad target, picked somebody who also had a firearm. This was about 3:30 Wednesday afternoon, broad daylight. 16-year-old walks up to the 27-year-old, whips out his gun, demands his belongings. The 27-year-old draws his own firearm, fires once at the 16-year-old, hitting him in the chest. 16-year-old taken to a local hospital where he passed away from his injuries. The 27-year-old gun owner has been questioned but has not been arrested. So it's, I don't know if there's been confirmation that this individual does have a concealed carry license. ABC7, though, says as of Wednesday evening, no charges have been filed. So if he did not legally possess that firearm, we'll know pretty quickly. But certainly the act of shooting the would-be armed robber is seen as an act of self-defense. And I highly doubt that the 27-year-old is going to face charges for that. But we will keep our eyes open for any more details on that defensive gun use in Chicago as well. And finally today, our good deed of the day. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. I guess we've just got a trend of really disturbing stories here. This is from Hollywood, Florida. Good Samaritan rescues woman after ex-girlfriend allegedly sets her ablaze. Yeah. This was Tuesday in an apartment in Hollywood, Florida. What police are describing as a domestic disturbance that led to this woman being immolated. The Good Samaritan in question, his name is David. Didn't want to give his last name to local media. He's actually a fire marshal. He said that he heard screaming on Monday night and looked out his window and he saw a fire and he saw two women inside this burning apartment. So he said, I ran to the hallway here and I punched this, the glass where the fire extinguisher is. He said, I got the fire extinguisher. He said, I ran upstairs and I was banging on the door. He said, the smoke was so thick you can't run in there. It's just billowing out. With the fire extinguisher, he was able to put out the flames, but then he realized one of the individuals in that apartment was horrifically burned. He said it was painful to see. It was painful to hear. He said it wasn't like a typical scream of somebody who was scared. He said you could hear the pain. It's a different level of trauma. Officers say when they arrived, the victim was able to tell them that her ex-girlfriend, who's been identified as 48-year-old Kamisha Tarpley, threw gasoline on her and then again set her ablaze, suffering serious third-degree burns, taken to a local hospital for her injuries. Tarpley was arrested at the scene. She was still behind bars, at least as of Wednesday afternoon. Judge has denied bond in this case. She's facing several charges, including aggravated battery, as well as arson causing great bodily harm. I don't know if attempted murder is in her future, but David, this fire marshal who lived in that complex, saw what was going on and ran to the aid of what he thought at this point was running to the aid of both people in the apartment. But saving a woman's life in the process, truly heroic on David's part. So in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. We thank you for your very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I do want to thank you for being a part of the program. And if you stuck around through all three of those painful stories, extra thanks for that. We'll be back on Monday with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com between now and then, because we are keeping up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And it is a busy time. You know, sine die has been reached in Virginia, but we have a lot of state legislatures that are still in session. We've got some pro-gun bills that are actually starting to move in Louisiana. We're seeing campus carry that's been introduced. We're still waiting to see what, Utah Governor Spencer Cox is going to do with a bill that would kind of make a trade, I guess, and expand permitless carry in Utah to college and university campuses, 18, 19, starting at age 18. But it would allow only concealed carry on college and university campuses, no open carry. That bill has passed the legislature. It's gone to the governor. We'll see what he does with it. But there are a number of other bills that we are watching in states across the country. Plus, we still have a lot of court decisions that we are awaiting, including the Third Circuit's decision in the New Jersey ban on so-called assault weapons, large capacity magazines, and the Supreme Court meeting and conference this week. We'll get the orders on Monday. Among the cases that are being discussed, you've got five cases dealing with gun and magazine bans. You've got, I believe this is the first week that Schoenthal versus Raul is being heard. Yes, it is. This is the challenge to the gun ban on public transportation in Illinois. Just saw this week there's been several horrific crimes on the property of the Chicago Transit Authority, despite an increased police presence. And in this case, remember, a district judge said, yeah, this ban's unconstitutional. Seventh Circuit reversed, said, no. The Second Amendment allows for carry bans in basically all crowded public spaces, which is not what the Supreme Court said in Bruin. So the Supreme Court does have the opportunity to set things right. So besides Schoenthal versus Rule, you have Grant versus Higgins, Nagger versus Lamont. Those are challenges to Connecticut's ban on so-called assault weapons. Viramontes versus Cook County, which is a challenge to Cook County's ban on so-called assault weapons. Duncan versus Bonda, challenge to California's magazine ban. Gators Custom Guns versus Washington, that is a challenge to Washington State's magazine ban. So all of those, again, scheduled to be discussed in conference this week, and we could learn their fate on Monday, whether they get a granted cert, whether they're denied, or whether they are kept once again in a holding pattern, which, as we talked with Costas yesterday, if the court doesn't grant cert to Duncan versus Bonda and these other affiliated hardware cases, keeping them on a hold is the next best thing. Dismissing them outright would be very bad news. We know that Third Circuit opinion is going to be coming fairly soon. Oral arguments were held 4 months ago. We know that the Third Circuit en banc panel is likely to rule New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines unconstitutional, at least in some respects. So hopefully the court, if they're not ready to take one of these cases, then hopefully the court will hang on to them until we get the Third Circuit decision. And then hopefully we'll see a hardware ban case accepted by the Supreme Court. So got a lot to watch for on Monday as well. Anyway, enjoy the rest of your week. Hope you have a great weekend. It is going to be, if we were going from really, really cold to really, really hot this weekend, you probably are as well. Hopefully I'm going to have some time to go down to my little shooting spot and spend a couple of hours. But boy, I got a lot of yard work to do outside too. But I'm going to try to carve out some time. Not in the heat of the day, but maybe early Saturday or Sunday morning. Anyway, you have a great rest of your week. We'll see you back here soon. Until then, oh, I should also mention, if you haven't already, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe, use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off of your membership, whether it's a VIP membership, VIP Gold, VIP Platinum. Whatever level you choose, you're going to get some great benefits. And whatever level you choose, you're going to be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, and I want to thank you for that very much. Again, BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT and get 60% off your membership. All right. Now, I'll say goodbye. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again. Be well. Be safe. And be free.